Very special episode of At the Table. This episode was recorded live Sunday, October 14th, 2012 at the New York Comic Con. The speakers are Charles Bronstein, founder and director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, and a young man by the name of Ryan Handley, who experienced firsthand the horror of being accused of a thought crime. I urge you to listen to the complete episode, and when you have finished listening to it, I would like to urge you to go to cbldf.org and make a donation. Also, I would like to urge you, if you enjoyed the podcast, to also consider making a donation to Netroots Radio, and which is netrootsradio.com. There's a PayPal button for both. Thank you, and now, manga is not a crime.
Sunday presentation, the fight to defend manga, criminal prosecutions of manga in the United States and Canada. I'm Charles Brownstein. I'm the executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. And before we get started, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge all of the volunteers that are giving their time this weekend to make a great Comic-Con for everybody. It might seem like the coolest, most fun job in the world to get in for Comic-Con for free, but actually they're working their tails off. So I'd like to acknowledge them all over there. So I see a lot of the same faces that came out to our History of Comic Censorship panel on Friday, and I thank you for that. For those that are new, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund is a not-for-profit organization that was established in 1986 to protect the First Amendment rights of the comic book field. And the fund was formed in the middle of a 50-year period where comics were the target of legal controversy. And you'll see that time and again, the same arguments against new media are persistent. That back in the 1920s, jazz music was going to be the ruination of everybody because of its syncopation. In the 1980s, when I was growing up, it was heavy metal is going to be the ruination of kids because of songs about the devil. You know, well, I didn't end up a devil worshiper. I ended up protecting free speech, which might be worse. You know, in the 1990s, it was violent video games. You know, in the 2000s, it was the internet. But the moment that really, where you really saw this moral panic completely reshape how an art form was developing was in comic books. And in the 1940s and in the 1950s, there was what's called moral panic about how comic books were going to warp and degrade the youth of America. And it actually led to Senate subcommittee hearings in the 1950s where the medium was put on trial and investigated in the context of our comic books creating a generation of delinquents because of a work of junk science called Seduction of the Innocent by a well-meaning but ill-intended, but a well-meaning doctor named Dr. Frederick Wortham. This led to the establishment of the Comics Code Authority, which served to sanitize the content of comics. So there you had a moment where people were saying, I'm horrified by what my kid is looking at. It's making kids into delinquents, so we need to do something about it. And the industry was backed into a corner where if we don't self-censor, we're going to be subject to government regulation. And so they did self-censor, and it created a stigma about comic books. And it persisted into the 1970s, where the target of prosecution started moving to retailers who were selling the generation of underground comics, you might be aware of people like Robert Crumb or things like the Freak Brothers. These came out of that movement, and they were created for the counterculture audience that was part of rock music and alternative arts and media of the time. And it was there that the target of censorship moved from the publisher level, which in the 1950s they were trying to change the way comics were published, to the retailer level, where people were actually being prosecuted for selling adult comics to adults. They were being prosecuted for selling work that is constitutionally protected to an audience that's appropriate for them. And the second wave of these criminal cases occurred in the 1980s, when the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund was established. And that was a time where the industry looked at our history and said, in the 1950s, they shut us down. And in the 1970s, they shut us down. In the 1980s, when we're starting to get popular acclaim because of works like Mouse by Art Spiegelman, which is a Pulitzer Prize-winning memoir about his parents' struggle with the Holocaust and his own struggle to understand them and what they went through, or Watchmen by Alan Moore, which used the superhero idiom to speak to the panic and paranoia of Cold War United States, or Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns, which was an allegory about the political media environment at the time. These things were getting mainstream attention, and people were saying, wow, comics have something important to say. They're not just for half-wits and children, which was the stigma prior to. And it was in that environment that a case came in 1986 where police were saying, no, comics are for kids, and selling this material that speaks to adult readers is really stuff that's designed to warp kids, and we're going to prosecute. And it was from there that the industry said, no, we're not going to take this line down anymore. And they established the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund to stand up for the rights of the field. And ever since then, we've been standing up for retailers, we've been standing up for artists, and more recently, we've been standing up for readers who are prosecuted. And just like in the past, comic books were the target of moral panic and outrage, just like in the past, rock music was the target of moral panic and outrage, just like in the past, video games were the target of moral panic and outrage, today we're finding that manga is becoming a target for moral panic and outrage. And as everybody here in this room knows, manga is an international force. But right now, we're at the moment in the development of this robust art form internationally where we get it, but the people outside of our world don't quite understand it yet. And so you're seeing things happening like at Borders, people regarding that manga is a buzzword for porn. And they're looking at all of the material with a stigma and looking at all of the material as if it's somehow deviant and underground. And part of it is because we're dealing with cultural differences. Japanese culture has very different taboos about sexual conduct and nudity. It has different taboos about what our imagination is able to explore. And manga freely explores the imagination in ways that are clean and fun for young readers, and in ways that explore the darker side for adult audiences. It's a language. It's a language about our imagination. And all language about imagination leads to moments where people go, I don't understand that, and I don't understand why you're looking at it, and I want to take it away. And part of this is because manga culture is on the rise. Right now, in this room, in this hall, tens of thousands of people are coming out to celebrate this important language and this important culture. A generation of North American readers has grown up on this. In fact, we're into the second or third right now. And as this generation that grew up on manga become adults, so do their tastes in manga. And because manga has a 60-some-year history of making content for audiences of all ages, that stuff is coming over now as well. And as we find access to it, that's where we're starting to see that manga prosecutions are beginning. And so this afternoon, I'm going to discuss four cases, and I'm going to discuss the disturbing trend that we're witnessing, which is that in the early part of this century, the targets of legal prosecution were comic book stores. And in the wake of a new law called the Protect Act, we're seeing the target move to readers, and we're seeing readers being unjustly tried under grotesque accusations. So the first major manga case was in 2000. It was called Texas versus Castillo. And this was a case against Jesus Castillo, who was a clerk in his early 20s at a store called Keith's Comics in Dallas, Texas. And in this case, an undercover police officer came into the store and went into the adult material section and bought a variety of books, but most notably, the ones that led to his arrest were Demon Beast Invasion, The Fallen, and Urotsuka Doji, Legend of the Overfiend, two popular horror comics containing strong sexual content. And when Mr. Castillo was arrested and taken to trial, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund came to his aid, and we paid for his defense, and we deployed the experts. But here we were dealing with the moral panic I was talking about at the beginning of this presentation. The prosecutor's case hinged entirely on the perception that comics are a medium explicitly for children, and that the manga in question is not art, but is obscene material that's designed to warp the moral development of kids. We brought in experts to argue about the importance of the category and the fact that comics, manga, is a language. It is a language just like film, it is a language just like prose, and it can speak to all audiences. We brought in Dr. Susan Napier, who is an expert of Asian studies, who at the time was teaching at a Texas campus, who talked about the cultural merit of manga and the medium status in Japan, and how it comes as part of a larger art tradition. We brought Scott McCloud, the comics scholar and expert whose understanding comics was the first major piece using the comics medium to explain to lay readers how it works. And he testified about the fact that the comics in question were designed for adult audiences, completely appropriate and constitutionally protected for adults to have. We also brought in a private investigator who testified that this isn't the only kind of material that was found in the community that was like this. And with the law, the way it works is that if there's comparable material in the community, they can't say that this work in particular falls afoul of the community standard. Because for something to be obscene, it has to fail what's called the Miller test. And this says that a work must be patently offensive, it must appeal to the prurient interest in sex or excretion, it must not have any redeeming social, artistic, literary, or scientific value. And so we brought in experts to speak to all of these things. And in fact, the work does possess this value. And the fact that the work is still sold and still celebrated today is evidence of that. But unfortunately, in the prosecutor's closing arguments, they brought no experts. They brought no contradictory testimony. They said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I don't care what type of evidence or what type of testimony is out there. Use your rationality. Use your common sense. Comic books, traditionally what we think of, are for kids. This is in a store, directly across from an elementary school, and it is put in a medium, in a forum, to directly appeal to kids. And that is why we are here, ladies and gentlemen. We are here to get this off the shelf. They didn't listen to the notions of merit. They didn't care about the fact that so many of us see this as art. They didn't care that so many of us identify with this as art. They said, I don't see it as art. You want to put this on the Jumbotron at the football stadium, so why should it be accessible in our community? The jury sided with the prosecution. Jesus was sentenced to 180 days in jail, a $4,000 fine, and 1 year of probation. We immediately appealed Jesus' case. We immediately were able to get the second set of charges dismissed and let this first one go to appeal. We were ultimately unsuccessful in this, despite our best efforts. The appeals court sided 2-1 with the original jury, citing that there wasn't a legal error in the decision, but that the jury made their judgment as a community of peers. So ultimately, Jesus was able to serve his sentence without going to jail. He had what's called a suspended sentence. But it was the first time that manga was brought under legal attack in the United States. And despite our best efforts, it resulted in a loss. And in 2003, the landscape changed. So previously, most obscenity cases work on this notion that the point of last distribution is the point where the arrest happens. And what that usually has been taken to mean is that the individual selling it is the person that's targeted. And in 2003, there was a law called Protect, which shifted the landscape to where now cases are coming against the people actually reading the material. And Protect is a very frustrating law because half of it is extremely good. It's a law that was designed to combat child sex abuse and child exploitation through child pornography and other abhorrent and terrible crimes. But what it also did was create a new category of law called obscene child pornography, which is a law that criminalizes the non-photographic image. And so the purpose of child pornography laws is to prosecute and prevent real people from being hurt. Child pornography, by definition, is photographic evidence of a crime. Photographic evidence of the worst crime. photographic evidence of adults exploiting and tarnishing the lives of real young people who were not old enough to give consent. And this muddied the waters, and it said that any visual depiction of any kind, including a drawing, a cartoon, a sculpture, a painting, that depicts a minor engaging in sexually explicit conduct and is obscene, or an image that is or appears to be a minor engaging in bestiality, sadistic or masochistic abuse, or sexual intercourse, and lacks the serious merit, is to be prosecuted as if it were photographic evidence of a crime. And manga has become challenged under this law. And part of the problem is that there is a lack of understanding about what the medium is, and there's a lack of understanding about the value of the content. And as everybody here knows, manga speaks a lot to the emotional reality that is happening in its readers' lives. And so it speaks to the transformations that happen psychologically. And so if you're reading a horror manga, there will be some fantastic images that will be interpreted as bestial. Tentacles, anyone? If you are reading, I'll take questions at the end. If you are reading a comic that involves the description of nascent sexuality, a lot of times, this is something that a professor at Meiji University said to me, a lot of times you will deal with a scenario where somebody is shown in their normal form, which is they're just drawn in the style that they're normally drawn with the minimal lines, and then as they move into a sexual situation, their features are exaggerated, and then at the end of that situation they might be shown in a more diminutive form, in a more childlike form, in a way that's shown to express vulnerability, in a way that's shown to express the emotional dimensions of what's happening in that character's head. And this is just a stock and trade category. And in the United States, we're awfully literal about everything. And so these laws that are designed to combat a culture of sexual media that is literal and photographic in nature doesn't distinguish between an artwork that is speaking to the emotional dimensions happening within the reader and within the character. It's just seeing, well, that panel number 7 on that page, that character is drawn in what you and I would call the Moe style, or what they would call like a 6-year-old. And this kind of misunderstanding has led to prosecutions. The very first case to test the Protect Act was U.S. v. Horley. And Horley was a bad guy, and that created an immediate problem, but in this particular instance, he was charged because he was a bad guy and he was accessing material that probably he shouldn't have been prosecuted for. Horley used computers in the Virginia Employment Resource and downloaded manga that they alleged depicted children engaged in sexually explicit content with adults. He printed out some of these and was charged with knowingly receiving child pornography for printing out 2 cartoons and viewing others. And again, Horley had a prior conviction. Corley was a bad guy. He didn't come to us for aid, and if he did, we would have only deployed an expert to testify on the comics part of it. But in 2006, a jury found him guilty for receiving this material, and he was sentenced to 20 years in prison with a 10-year probation thereafter for receiving drawings that they alleged were child pornography. So that opened up the precedent. This guy who received drawings like this was prosecuted under the same mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines as if he had downloaded photographs of real people being hurt. The second case we did get involved with, and this one's a lot more upsetting, because Christopher Hanley was an upstanding citizen. Christopher Hanley was a manga collector who was arrested in 2006 after postal inspectors viewed a package of manga he ordered from Japan. And one thing that, if you don't already know, and I'm not saying this to make you paranoid, but just because it's a reality, is that the postal inspection, the customs office has the right to look at anything you order. And so he ordered a number of materials from Japan, including some doujin. And after receiving this package at the post office in Chicago, they said, we think that some of this stuff is questionable, and so they alerted the federal government. The federal government had it so that he had to go into the post office to affirmatively pick it up. He was followed to his home by federal and local police, who walked in, arrested him, went down to his basement, which was his rec room, where he had all of his lifetime's worth of comics and manga books and DVDs and computers, and it seized his entire life collection of material. And the thing that's really upsetting about this is that Chris Cameron was a model citizen with no criminal record. He was a computer programmer. He served in the United States Navy. He was honorably discharged. He possessed a disability. He lived with his disabled mother, taking care of her. And his passions in life, this disabled 40-year-old man, were manga and Bible study. And while that might seem like strange bedfellows to some, the fact is, he wasn't hurting anybody. He was engaging in a religious life. He was engaging in a life of service to his family and to his community. And he, more damningly, on all of these machines, possessed no photographic pornography of any kind. So he was a collector of the category as a whole, and he possessed no images of any real people, not minors or adults. And while he awaited trial, he was tarred as if he were a person committing the most horrible crime in the world. So while Chris was awaiting trial, prosecutors didn't distinguish between manga and obscene material. They saw it all as the same thing. They prohibited him from viewing or accessing any manga or anime on the internet. He couldn't order any anime or manga, video or written material. And most significantly, he couldn't engage in internet chat, which harmed his ability to prepare his defense. And so consider that Chris possessed a giant room full of an encyclopedic collection of manga. And ultimately, the case they brought against him hinged around 7 years. And unlike Corley, who was convicted for the mere possession of the images, the court here found that the images had to be obscene. That was one of the good things. But ultimately, he was facing mandatory minimums, and he decided that this is just too scary. And so Chris pleaded guilty to possession of the child pornography they were accusing him of. And he served 6 months in jail. Now, here's the heartbreaking part, as if that wasn't bad enough. So, we were not running Chris's case, and I really wish we were. We were consulting experts on Chris's case, and we found out by reading the government sentencing document that the government said, we acknowledge that this guy is not a threat to anybody, but this is an unusual case about an unusual man. And because he is looking at these manga drawings that we think are deviant, he displays a sexual deviancy that needs to be punished. And you can read the original documents on cbldf.org. But what's horrible in this case is that a reader was prosecuted for the images that he read that were part of his imaginative life. And the government said, your imaginative life is deviant. This is their word. And feeling frightened by the example of Corley, he said, this is just too risky. And you can't blame anybody for taking the plea, because nobody knows what it's like to be inside the horrible vice of a case. But I'm confident that had we been able to run his case and had we been able to go to trial, we could have shown the artistic and literary merit, and we could have shown the therapeutic merit about how reading art is a helpful way to process emotions, because that really is a lot of what manga is about. And so these here are the 7 books that Mr. Hanley was ultimately convicted for. And so I'm talking to you about all of this, and you're like, oh my God, what a horrible bummer. And it is. But we're starting to see the tide change. Just this year, there was an important report that was released in Denmark that was commissioned by the government that said there is no evidence whatsoever that manga drawings encourage pedophilia. There is no evidence whatsoever that manga drawings of deviant material encourage deviant behavior. And this is an important thing, because manga is about our imagination. It's about being free to think and read what we want to think and read. And if you don't like it, change the channel. Nobody's forcing anybody to look at anything. But we should not be hindered in our imaginations. And it took one brave American to score a victory in the North American courts for this. There was a case that started a few years ago that we're about to talk about, where one person put everything on the line. One person was abused visiting a friend from the United States going into Canada by the authorities, who thought that manga was a code word for porn, who looked at otherwise innocuous material and said that this is deviant, and who said, we're going to ruin your life. We're going to say that you are guilty of the worst thing in the world, and we dare you to fight back. And he did. And he won. And so I'd like to bring that man onto the stage now. Everybody, can we have a round of applause for Ryan Matheson? Now, Ryan, in 2010, you were 25 years old. You're a computer programmer. Tell me a bit about your relationship with manga and, you know, kind of what was happening when you were going out to visit your friend.
Well, I've been a fan of manga and anime since I was... like, 6 or 7. My first manga was probably Ranma. I also really liked Sailor Moon, and I watched this on TV when it was on TV back in the day. What happened in 2010 was I was going to visit a friend in Canada, and it was my first big trip that I was taking by myself. I was flying by myself, and so it was all this new stuff, you know, going across the border and everything like that. And so I was really excited. And I was really excited, and so I brought a bunch of my computers, and I bought my iPad, and my iPhone, and all these electronics, because I'm kind of a geek, obviously. So, and I was visiting my friend who's also a big geek, and we're programmers, and so I thought, well, I can bring my stuff, and we're going to program, we're going to have fun, we're going to watch anime and stuff. And so... I took my flight there, and everything was going great. You know, I was being encouraged, oh, I'm flying and stuff. And so I got to the border, ended up the second to last in line, and then I finally got up there. Everything looked to be okay. I got a text from my friend saying, are you there? So I thought, well, I'll just wait to respond to my friend after they get through customs. It'll just be a few minutes, right? So... I got up to the front booth where they asked you some questions. I said, oh, yeah, I have some electronics. So, yeah, okay. And then, so they sent me to immigrations, and they asked me, how did you meet your friend? And I said, well, I met my friend on the Internet. And I think that was a big first flag for them. And they said, well, how did you meet him on the Internet? I said, well, I met him on a chat room, which I did way back in the day in an AOL chat room or something. You know? And so they said, oh, what chat room? You must be some sort of stalker or something. Even though my friends were 28 back then. So, and they were at the airport there to pick me up, and they actually talked to the customs officers. They still, you know, let this flag raise about me. And so they sent me to get searched by two guys instead of one for some reason. And they started going through my stuff. Really only caring about the electronics. So they immediately just took out my laptop and they said, okay, enter your password. So at this point, I was thinking, well, you know, it's my first time crossing the border anywhere. And so, you know, that must be a flag too. So they're going to want to search me. So, okay, here's my password because I've got nothing bad on here. You know, I just want to get through and go visit my friend. So I entered my password, and then they went on my iPad too. So they just started looking through that stuff for 2 hours, and then it just kept going. And so I was just sitting there watching them look through my stuff. And at some point they said, oh, what's this? Actually, I'll back up a little bit. I remember them opening my computer, and they saw my wallpaper, which is just a regular anime wallpaper. It's not... You know, there's no nudity or anything like that. It's just a regular anime wallpaper. And I remember them, their eyes kind of lighting up a little bit about that, like, oh. And then they continued searching. And I noticed a few things. They asked me, well, what's this? And it was an art book page. It was a scan of one of the art books I have. So I said, well, that's an illustration. And they said, well, this stuff, you should be careful with this stuff. You know, we shouldn't bring this stuff here. And I was confused. I was like, why?
What was it showing?
It was an illustration of a girl in a summer outfit or something like that. And so, again, no nudity or anything, but just, I guess, because she looked annoying, you know, young to them, I guess. And so they kept searching. After 2 hours, they said, okay, we're going to put you in detention. And they said, oh, I'm not being arrested. And so they brought me back to this room where one of the guys kept searching my computer, you know, like every file on my computer. And the other guy talked to me. He's kind of crazy. He kind of just, he kept, I guess, I think he was trying to distract me and kind of keep me calm because this was kind of starting to get ridiculous at that point. And so the guy kept searching my computer, kept searching, and eventually the guy talked to me and said, oh, you know, 15 minutes can legally have to let you go because they can only hold you in detention at customs like that for 4 hours before they're forced to release you. And so about half an hour or so goes by, and then they said, oh, we're going to call the police. And so they called the police, and the police arrives half an hour later. And so the police got there, and that's when I knew something was up. And so the police, you know, they looked at the stuff. They obviously didn't really know what to do. And so they, the police eventually charged me, put me in handcuffs, and brought me out the back and gave me the police stop. And so when I got to the police station, that's, you know, the big, you know, strip search and all that stuff. And then one of the female police officers asked, as I was coming in, she asked, oh, what's this guy in for? And the police guy that brought me in said, told her my charges. And her eyes just turned. It's the most mean look I've seen. Like she thinks I am the devil. She was just, her eyes wanted to kill me. And so I was thinking, like, what is going on here? Obviously, she didn't know any of the circumstances or anything. But eventually, they brought me down to the jail cell, which was freezing cold. And because it was in Canada in April. So it's freezing cold, and no blankets, no pillows, nothing like that. I asked a couple times for blankets.
It was like a concrete slab.
It was a concrete slab, yeah. Oh, yeah, they said, when the custom guys were talking to me, they said, we're not sure what this is, so we're going to have you stay overnight at the police station. You know, they have a bed there. We're just going to figure this out. Just go stay at the bed at the police station. It'll be okay. And then got there, and it's super hard concrete slab on the floor. Super cold, no blankets, no pillows. They wouldn't give you any blankets. They wouldn't give you my jacket back. And I eventually had to use toilet paper. They did give me toilet paper, so I used that as a pillow and blankets. And they didn't feed me, even though I asked like 6 times. Eventually they get better the next day.
But they just belittled you. Like the whole food thing was so infuriating. Oh, we'll check with the chef.
Right.
And they just belittled you.
I asked 6 times. So the first time I asked, they said, oh, sure, we'll go get it. And the second time they said, oh, yeah, we'll go ask the chef to make a meal for you. And I kept saying that. And then, you know, at some point I realized they're just making fun of me. So I gave up trying. And then
they also, you know, and I really, you know, want to interject and I admire your courage, right, to come up here and talk about this, because a lot of people would just say, it's done, it's behind me, but I think it's really important that, and really admirable that you're telling your story, because this isn't an anomaly. And, you know, the whole time, they were treating you as intimidation, and so, you know, what could you please talk a bit about, you know, some of the intimidating language that they were using, transporting them?
Right. So, they transported me to the courthouse, and when you're charged with a crime like this, you have to get put in like a special spot in the transportation vehicle, like solitary confinement or something like that. They wouldn't put me in that. They would put me in the general spot, and then they would kind of just laugh and walk off, and then eventually the lieutenant would come by and he would move me to the right spot. And they would slam the door on my head as I was getting in. When I finally finally got to the detention center. So I went from the police station jail to the courthouse and then to their short-term detention center. When I went to the detention center, the guards were bringing me in and they asked me, well, what did you do? You must have done something bad or childhood because we're bringing you to this special wing of the facility. And so I just kind of nodded and they said, well, you know, if you get raped in there, it doesn't count. And so they were just laughing at me. And so I was thinking that doesn't really make me feel better. I'm just trying to get through this. So they told me to come up with a crime, and they suggested, well, why don't you just say it was assault? I guess because they assumed that it was a violent child crime, because they had no idea. And so I guess I went through that while staying there. Which I realized that after the fact. At that point in time, I was so scared. So I said, fine, I'll just say it was assault, even though it doesn't make sense, and there's no way I would ever assault anyone. I went through the detention hallway. I had a drug dealer as a jailmate, and another guy was, I didn't know what he was in there for, but he was and smelled, and he was kind of also very crazy. But the drug dealer guy, for some reason, was nice. But I got through that all right. It was, I mean, honestly, like, jail is the worst experience in my life. It is ridiculous. It's inhumane. But, I mean, that was only 5 days, too. Eventually, as soon as the day after I arrived and I was in jail, my parents and my brother were rescuing me and trying to figure out what's going on. My friend posted on Facebook to my brother's Facebook asking what it was, and so they knew immediately, and you know, it still took, you know, the paperwork and stuff 5 days to get it all.
The thing too, and when I read a lot of the forums, it's really easy on the internet to think the worst of your neighbor and your fellow fan, and I see people say that, it must be Lolly, it must be some horrible thing. And the truth of the matter is that even if it is LollyCon or something like that, it's drawings. No drawings were hurt in commissioning these drawings. But what you had wasn't even that. And so, you know, I'm going to show everybody one of the cartoons that was a focal point in Canada's prosecution, the next slide. And I'm introducing it because I see some young people in here, and their parents need to make the decision if they want to move the screen or not. I don't think it's anything bad, but that's me, not you. It was a parody of a famous Japanese image that was from the early 20th century called the 48 sumo positions, which, in the way that humans do, because we always think about sex, whether we want to or not, it was immediately changed by some wiseacre into the 48 sex positions. And this was then taken recently and changed into the Moe style. So it was the 48 positions Moe style. And so this image is one that was intended humorously. You can find readily anywhere online. And the Canadian authorities said that this image that's on Ryan's computer was obviously depicting the abuse of four-year-olds. No drawings were heard in the commission of this drawing. Everybody here that knows anything about the category is, you know, I read posts all the time about, well, this thing makes me uncomfortable over here, whether it's, you know, a particularly violent hentai or whether it's a, you know, piece of lolly. And they go, well, that stuff makes me uncomfortable, and so that's the line that should be against the law. And the thing is, we know what the variations on manga is. The police, the customs agents, they don't know. And so they're looking at this drawing, and they're looking at drawings like this. So this is like Love Is cartoons, if anybody remembers that from, you know, their paper or from their, you know, uncle's paper. You know, this is extremely innocuous stuff, and this stuff is not much different from cases that we had to deal with in libraries, where in Dragon Ball, you know, Goku is depicted naked, and you know, this has been the cause of the case. And so this image, the 48 positions Moe style, is one of the things that led to Ryan's arrest, and that's why it's so important to be aware of our rights, and it's so important that Ryan stood up for his rights, because we got to educate people that this stuff is not deviant stuff, and why are we spending resources that should go into getting violent predators off the streets and prosecuting guys like Ryan. But Ryan, you know, that harrowing jail experience, you know, that really was awful, but from what you told me, that wasn't what you judged to be the worst of it. So let's talk about, you know, the fact that you still have to deal with this for 2 years of your life. What kind of conditions did they impose upon you?
Well, when I finally, when it was the fifth day, and they finally got this video thing for the courthouse. So there was a lawyer there for me, and he said, okay, I think I got it. I'm not happy with the conditions, but he told me that basically no internet outside of work. Actually, at the beginning, there was no internet, no computers outside of a very specific named job that I was looking at. At that point in time, it wasn't just for work. It was if you don't work for this company, you can't use a computer, you can't use internet. Also, obvious conditions like you can't have any contact with minors, you can't, no pornography, stuff like that, the regular conditions that you expect. But that went on for, those conditions went on for a year, until the end of 2010 when I had to fly back to Canada to change them, because they won't let you change them over the phone or anything, or you know, video or whatever.
And your hours got cut, right? So
so this specific company I was working for was not doing so well in the economy, and my hours got cut down to like 5 to 10 hours a week. And I mean, honestly, these days you can't even apply for a job unless you have an internet connection, you know, apply online and send your resume. So I couldn't even get a non-computer job. So I was still working for this company until at some point, like I didn't have work one week and stuff. So I said, I need to be able to work for a different company. And so I contacted my lawyer and flew down in December of 2010. And they got the prosecution to budge to just change it so that it says no computers, no internet outside of work in general. And you know, at the time, it seemed like a huge concession for them to do that. Like, my lawyer asked me, you need to give me a specific date, a specific reason, and things like that. So, like, we got that changed. So I was able to finally get work the next year. But besides the work, it was, like, I mean, I've been on, you know, AOL, the internet, since forever. And so not being able to use the internet and talk to my friends, most of those are online. It was really difficult. Like, you can go, like, if you go on a vacation for, like, 2 weeks, or a month even, with no internet, which, I mean, if you go on vacation nowadays, you have your cell phone, you have internet anyway, but if you go for a month, you can get through that, but 22 months was ridiculous. Like, that was hard.
Yeah, it was as if you were placed in an isolation chamber, you know, here in the 21st century. And so, you had very good lawyers, and was it about a year in that we got involved? I think you contacted us?
Yeah, it was the end of 2010.
And so at the end of 2010, Ryan got in contact, and we were able to build a coalition with the Canadian organization, the Comics Legends Legal Defense Fund, to help support Ryan's case. And so the CLLDF contributed $11,000 from their coffers. We contributed an immediate $20,000 from ours. And we're all small organizations, but this is important. And we also contributed expert support and legal support to Ryan's case. And so, in addition to the extremely good legal counsel that we started to help pay for. And by the way, the case was projected to cost $150,000, and that's a reduced rate. And so, you know, just to protect your innocence, you know, you're facing these life-altering things. And, you know, you and your family were backed, you know, a good corner, you know, before you reach us, and you had to put in a lot of your own money into it. And something your mom said to you still blows me away to this day. So, you know, before we got involved, before, you know, any of this became, we're going to take this head on, can you talk about the moment where you decided to take it head on and that conversation with your mom?
Right, so at the end of 2010, so through 2010, I was thinking, well, this is going to be over next month, because obviously I didn't do anything wrong. So it went on month after month until fall, around October, I guess. failed to test that in order to reduce the charges to obscene material. But at that point, I was thinking, I don't want to, even if they got it, I don't want to take it because, there was a plea at the beginning just to plead some of the original charges, but it was only 14 days. And so at that point, I thought, well, I can take it, I can just get the 14 days, and I'll do that okay, but I'll be on the sex offender registry. But at that point, I was really scared, and I was even thinking about that. And then, finally, after my lawyer failed to get the last obscene plea, I thought, well, this is ridiculous. You know, I love anime and manga. Why would I be willing to say that it's child pornography? Why would I even be willing to say it's obscene? And so, at that point, I just said, you know, I don't care anymore. I'm going to go to trial. I'm going to fight this. I'm not going to take an obscene plea. I'm not going to take the original plea. I'm just going to fight for it. And so I got really, really upset. And so I called my mom, and my mom told me that she said she's okay with me taking a plea. Because before that, my mom was really upset. She was upset the whole time, but before that, she was upset because of taking a plea, because she knew I didn't do it. You know, I didn't commit a crime. So she said, well, Ryan, if you think that's what it is, if you think the stuff they arrested you for is obscene or child pornography, whatever you're pleading to, if you believe that, then I'm okay with it. And then on the phone, I just kind of lost it and said, that's not what it is. That's ridiculous. I was really, really upset at that point. I told that to my mom. I said, I'm not going to take it. And I hung up and I was just on fire. I said, I'm not going to take this plea. I'm going to fight it. And so at that point, I just said, no. I told my lawyer, set the trial date for the trial. And so they set the trial, which is over a year in the future, which is February 6th. It was originally a week. It was actually originally 7 days long for a trial for two images. Because we had such a strong defense, and we had experts, and we had, at that point, that's what we had, the CPOPF. So it ultimately, like, I knew I was going to win.
And you can read all of the defense materials, and they are, you know, we don't fool around. We get dire wolves, and we deploy them. And, you know, and Ryan's team, you know, dire wolves, and they're very expensive, but you got to pay for the best. You know, we got tremendous experts to testify on the artistic merits. And, you know, ultimately, when you read the documents, which, you know, again, they're all on cbldf.org, you can see why the new prosecutor that came on and had to deal with the case had the reaction they did and what happened.
Yeah, we went through three or four prosecutors. I'm not sure why they kept leaving the case. But finally, the first one was insane. She just would not give up. She was really vicious and really aggressive. And the last one I got, I guess, was sane. Saw them and went to my lawyer. The prosecutor actually went to my lawyer and asked, what can we do about this? Can we arrange a plea bargain? So they tried to go through that original obscene material plea that they rejected back in 2010 and tried to get that. But my lawyer said, no. No, I said, screw you guys, we're not going to do that. And so my lawyer just did not let them do that. But at that point, there was the same prosecutor.
Yeah, and then, you know, ultimately through the process of not budging and through the strength of your convictions that we're going to take this to court, you know, they're like, well, we better cut our losses. And so, you know, in February of this year, because of Ryan's convictions, that this art that he loves, that we love, is not a crime, all criminal charges are dropped. And this is the first major victory. And while I think everybody agrees that we would have liked to see some precedent-bound thing in court saying that you can't do this, the fact that the body of defense exists that leads them to drop the charges, the fact that we've got this new report from Denmark, and hopefully more reports come out here in the United States, showing that, you know, manga is not a impulse to deviant behavior, the tide has changed. The tide wouldn't have changed, Ryan, unless you actually stood up for your rights, and you did. And we're just, I can't applaud you enough for that. But the problem is that these things are still happening. You know, just this summer, a case came before the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund where a man in Idaho was placed under a unlawful investigation because a jilted ex-lover went to police and said that my ex is into child porn and it's all over his computers, and you know, this really upset me so much that I can't be with him anymore, and you have to take him off the streets. He's a horrible person. And so in this small town, they went into this guy's house and they spent hours interrogating him, and they took his computers, put them in their trunk, and they said, oh, well, we're not arresting you, but we're taking your stuff and you're under investigation and don't expect to see it again, and you're under investigation for child pornography and you can't, you know, just sit tight because we're investigating you. What? What? And so, you know, he came to us and we were able to immediately deploy counsel to go into the police station and say, well, number one, what you did is illegal. You can't just seize somebody's materials. You can't just seize them without advising them of their rights. You can't do this. You have to return the materials. You have to drop the investigation. This is against the law. That's thing one. And thing number two, the material's not against the law. And so what this guy had on his computer, and I can't use the name, obviously, because it went away, thank goodness. Because let me tell you something, in the Google world, the mere allegation of this awful crime will ruin your life. Which is another reason why Ryan is so courageous letting his name be used to underscore that this danger is out there. So a malicious ex says, my ex is into this stuff, and you have to investigate. It's a really scary thing that kind of allegation can be used and can be used against a category that the law doesn't understand. So what was on the computer? Manga. Manga material and furry comics. And this is stuff that we love and that we have a right to love. But if the law enforcement doesn't understand it, they can intimidate you. They can make you feel like you're a creep. They can make you feel like you're an outcast, and they can make you feel like you're alone. And the important thing is that you're not alone. The important thing is that the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, for 2.5 decades, has been fighting for the rights of comics to enjoy the same First Amendment protection as any other form of media. As movies, which we don't question, are protected by the First Amendment, as art and museums, which no question is protected by the First Amendment. And 25 years ago, it was, well, these black and white comics that speak to adult readers, you know, this is creepy stuff that's designed to warp kids. And comics are for mutants anyway, so, you know, lock these guys up. And we changed that conversation. We protected comics to the degree that nobody anywhere thinks that comic books in the United States have no merit. People might not like them. People might challenge them in libraries for their content, but nobody's actually saying anymore, well, this is all low-value content because there's a body of work and protection. And, you know, 25 years ago, you would have the fans of mainstream comics that would look down their nose at the black and white stuff and say, well, I'm not into that weirdo stuff. And, you know, right now in this kind of environment where Marvel Comics is as mainstream as the NFL, you know, and people are extremely into this media, you know, I'm starting to see that same kind of attitude being expressed from fans of, you know, mainstream comics media that's all over the movies, you know, being sent towards manga fans. You know, well, I'm not into that weirdo stuff. Well, that attitude's going to go away. And that attitude's going to go away because this organization has been around to protect comics and all of its permutations, and there's a community that cares about comics and all of its permutations. And manga is a language that is growing with greater vibrancy and greater potency every day. And so it's all of us to band together for the art that we love. It's up to all of us to display solidarity with Ryan and show just one iota, because we can't, none of us in this room can show all of the courage that you showed, Ryan, and I mean that. It's up to all of us to say that what we love is not a crime. What we love is art. It's up to all of us not to draw battle lines on, well, that guy's into stuff I don't like, and that's creepy, and that should go away. If you don't like it, you don't need to look at it. You know, it's like, there's stuff that I have to defend that I don't like, and you know what? I don't need to shake the hand. I don't need to look at it. But we have a right to our imagination, and manga, more than any other form, is really about the imagination. And so we stand up for the fact that art is not child pornography. Art provides a safe place for individuals to explore their culture, to explore their identity, and to explore their ideas. And that prosecuting people for possession of manga doesn't serve the government's interest in stopping real people from being hurt. It's creating a category where the government is saying this is thought crime. Well, you know what? In the 1950s, they said the comics were a kind of thought crime that turned good kids into bad kids. In the 1980s, they said the comics were for kids and that anything that was trying to break out of that and speak to general audiences was somehow going to warp kids. And you know what? We killed both of those arguments. And we're going to kill this argument that says that manga is low-value speech that is deviant in nature. But we got to band together, and we can't do it alone. And so I encourage all of you to please join us, to please go and take a look at comicbooklegaldefensefund.org and learn about your rights. We have a lot of materials there for you. We have a number of resources about what to do when you're traveling, how to protect yourself, how to manage your data in a way that you reduce your vulnerabilities. We have a lot of information for librarians about banned comics, because that's another big thing that we do, is we help libraries and we help educators when comics are challenged in their libraries. We have hundreds of pages of information for you, and I encourage you to browse it, and I encourage you to spread the word. And I encourage you to join me in standing up for the fact that what we love is important, and we have a right to it, and nobody can take that away. And so I thank you all for your attention today. And just once more, Ryan, thank you so much for being brave and speaking to us and being an example. We have approximately 3 minutes, so I can take about two or three questions. And I'd also like to just acknowledge the corporate members that help us pay for our work. Are there any questions out there? Yeah? Yes, you.
I was just curious, what other First Amendment groups do you guys, you mentioned the ACLU,
the issue is, the question is, what other First Amendment groups do we work with? The Comic Book Legal Defense Fund is active in the First Amendment community. We are a sponsor of the Kids' Right to Read Project, which protects the right of parents to choose for themselves what they want their children to be able to read. And we help out in challenges where people try to take books off of shelves without following proper procedure. And next year we're working to create toolkits about comics and manga for that environment. We're a sponsor of Banned Books Week, the National Celebration of the Freedom to Read. We are a member of the Media Coalition, which is a group that is a legislative watchdog that fights unconstitutional laws as they are passed so that they don't become cases like this. And then, you know, in cases where we have specific actions, we will create coalitions. So, for instance, we created a coalition with Canada's Comic Legends Legal Defense Fund so that it wasn't just, you know, us Americans asserting our rights. You know, it was, this is an important international concern to protect this American and to protect Canadians who are being threatened under this law. So we do coalition work of that nature. I have time for one more. Yes, sir, in the back. Yes.
First of all, thank you for being here. It's so very, very cool.
Thank you.
Have you been able to work together with your community organizations in regards to the comic books?
The question is, were we able to work together with the with European or Middle Eastern? And the answer is that we haven't found a coalition to build, but we have had contact with some international rights organizations for cartoonists. And what we do is we help spread awareness. If you go to cbldf.org, we have a tremendous news blog that every day is updated with information about this material. So while there hasn't been an appropriate legal action that we can take, because we're chartered as a non-for-profit in the United States to protect the First Amendment, we do participate in information sharing and things of that nature. And before we go, you know, I also want to indicate that next year we're going to be releasing a major project of called Manga Introduction and Best Practices for parents and for librarians, that is attempting and very well to advance understanding of manga in the library environment, in the school environment, and it talks about, you know, the entire swath of the category in a way that demystifies it. Because the truth is, like I said at the beginning, manga is an international force. Manga isn't going anywhere. In fact, more and more people are going to love it every day. And one of the things that Ryan and I were remarking about at the conventions is it's so cool to see parents bringing their little kids and, you know, sharing this hobby with the next generation. And so we are working to create the tools to help raise awareness of why this is such an important international art form. And, you know, I encourage all of you to join me. Let's stand proud for what we love. Let's not live in shame or fear. Okay, I'm giving the sign that I'm going off the stage. So thank you all for your time.
And if you are listening to this on netrootsradio.com, I urge you to go to netrootsradio.com and also click on that PayPal button and support Progressive Internet Radio. Thank you, and I'll be talking to you later. Bye-bye.